thank you very much for joining our April webinar. This is our fourth one this year. We've got another one coming up next month. We're not quite ready to share what that's going to be, but we're looking forward to announcing that probably next week. Our guest today is Dr. Andrew Whittemore, who is a jobbing GP down in Portsmouth, but also clinical lead for Asthma and Lung UK. Dr. Whittemore joined us last year to talk about diagnostics for asthma. And he's kindly come back today to talk about management of asthma. So, Dr. Whittemore, probably over to you now.
Thanks, Elian, and nice to see you all again, and thanks for inviting me back. So last time, I think I sort of covered what asthma is and about the diagnosis of asthma. So naturally, we sort of move on to the management. There's a few things that I'm sort of hoping to cover today. We'll sort of recap what actually asthma is, what asthma control is, and then some of the principles of treatment, and then working on towards what is the guidelines at the moment and how you can support your patients with that. So as Ellie said, I've been a GP now for about 19 years down near Portsmouth. Very quickly, I was dumped in the role of clinical lead for respiratory within the practice because cough was starting and they needed somebody who was vaguely interested. That didn't fit me, but actually, as the newbie in the practice, they sort of delegated it to me and I took it from there. After putting myself through a short course to make sure I knew at least as much as our respiratory nurses, we then realised that I was the regional lead for respiratory, having done that course. So yeah, got dumped into it at the beginning, but it's become a passion, something I really enjoy doing as well. And having a portfolio of being a GP half the week and working on a variety of things with the charity gives me really good work-life balance and has been really good for my career as well. So just to really recap what asthma is. Is caused by inflammation in the airways. And that inflammation is caused and then made worse by being exposed to triggers. And then that inflammation itself causes reactions where the airway gets more narrow, you get mucus produced, and then that causes the typical symptoms of asthma of coughing, wheezing, and breathlessness. Some of the important factors about asthma is that because triggers and symptoms are variable, asthma itself can be very unpredictable. And one of my big bugbears is that at the moment we've got a once yearly system for reviewing people in cough, but asthma is a variable condition and usually we see people when they're well. Because of this, people often don't turn up to appointments because they don't see the benefit, but also you don't see people when they're actually struggling with their asthma as well. So people who've got untreated inflammation end up with narrowing of the airways, they get symptoms like cough, breathlessness, wheezing. When this is bad enough or then attacked by another trigger, then they can get an exacerbation where they get more severe symptoms, and that in turn can lead to asthma attacks and death. When you're assessing somebody with asthma, I think it's really important to reflect back to the patient and also from yourself as well, why they're getting the triggers that they're getting, the symptoms that they're getting. And there are so many different possible triggers for asthma, and everybody's unique. I know this time of year, I don't have asthma, but I get more mucus in my airways and in my nasal passages because of the increase in pollens, but I'd never say I've got hay fever. And it's very similar with lots of people out there who don't have a fixed diagnosis of hay fever or asthma or things like that. There are things in the air that increase the body's response to what's out there and help to protect you from those things. So people with asthma particularly, you can work out whether their symptoms are happening more when they have a virus or after having a virus, whether it's certain times of year or when they're exposed to certain things, whether it's pets or mold or pollens, or whether it's more all through the year. So when it's house dust mite or when they're exposed to particular dusty environments. Some people get set off when they've got sort of things in the air that aren't allergic, but they're more of an irritant, so smoking and pollution. And then you've got people where there's things inside them, so stress, exercise, and hormones has become an increasingly recognised trigger for people with asthma. And one thing about hormones to say is we see spikes in people getting asthma symptoms around puberty, around the menopause, and there are some women out there who get menstrual asthma symptoms. And then there's other conditions which can then set off asthma symptoms as well. So postnasal drip is probably the more common one. And that's very hard to tell apart from asthma because people might get the cough and that might cause some irritation, but it can also cause that the same sort of trigger for the postnasal drip can also cause asthma symptoms as well. And gastric reflux is something I always ask about. In terms of inflammation, there are two main markers that we can use. So FeNO is one that is recommended for diagnosis, but NICE doesn't recommend it for monitoring asthma. And eosinophil count, which again for me is a hint to some that one of my patients is getting symptoms that are potentially due to asthma, and then that gives me more direction that it could be due to asthma itself. The other part of asthma is, of course, not just inflammation, but the obstruction. And we're all very used to using peak flows to diagnose and to monitor asthma, but also then using spirometry when you need something more formal. In some cases, you might want to use spirometry for monitoring and assessing people when they've got asthma, but usually peak flow is more useful and less of a hassle. A single reading of peak flow in an annual review probably isn't of much use. If they're fit and well, it does give you a benchmark for other readings through the year. But if they're getting symptoms that could be due to asthma or something that's like asthma, then actually using peak flow is a good way of telling whether their symptoms are due to that or not. We get onto symptoms, we're a little bit more stuck into what we can actually objectively check. We're relying on history, validated asthma control test questionnaires, and actually measuring how much somebody is using their reliever inhaler. But I don't need to be the one to tell you that actually people use their reliever inhalers for all sorts of things, for every cough, for every episode of breathlessness, and not just when they're getting asthma symptoms. But it is a good marker that something isn't quite right with their symptom control at the time. Then you can assess asthma by asking about exacerbations. And this falls within cough again this year and is partly ascertained by taking it from the history, asking if they've had any flare-ups, but also reviewing the notes to see whether there's been any visits to urgent treatment centres or A&E, or whether they've just been prescribed oral steroids by the practice. We're looking at assessing whether somebody's got good asthma control. We want low levels of inflammation, so a FeNO level that's lower than 25, ideally. Eosinophils, it's useful in measuring whether somebody is controlled at that moment or not. But moving on to obstruction, if somebody has got no asthma symptoms and their asthma is under good control, then they will have airflow of 80% or greater than what they normally are, whether that's on peak flow or on spirometry. When you're assessing symptoms, we're aiming for no symptoms with asthma, whether daytime or nighttime. And anybody who's getting asthma symptoms more than three or more times per week has got poorly controlled asthma. And I think that's something that's massively under-recognized, not just by us, but by the public at large, and something we need to keep working on to get that message out there. But anybody who's getting any nighttime symptoms, that's actually a red flag for having an asthma attack or an exacerbation. The asthma control test is validated that anybody with a score greater than 20 has got good control. And I say we're looking at people getting asthma symptoms or using their blue reliever less than three times in every week, or three inhalers in a year is probably a good marker of what's going on there. And in terms of exacerbations, again, nobody should be getting exacerbations from asthma, as most of them should be preventable. So when we're talking about how many inhalers people are using a year, so looking at your blue reliever inhaler, one canister should last somebody about 11 months if they're not using it very often. We tend to use three as a cutoff because actually that allows people a little bit of variability through the year and having repeats or so on. Recent NHS sort of guidelines have suggested six is a good cutoff point to working out whether somebody is overusing or over-ordering their blue reliever. And the National Review of Asthma Deaths, which I'll talk about in more detail shortly, used 12 as a cutoff because that was where there was a significant marker for risk of death. And one important thing that has probably got asthma back in the headlines a little bit more recently, certainly in the medical press, is the impact of inhalers on the environment. We know that overusing reliever inhalers is bad for the environment for two reasons. Firstly, people with poor asthma control use a lot more healthcare resources than people with good asthma control. And that was covered in this very recent study in Thorax, which is sort of linked on the slides. The other thing is that Blue Relief inhalers also have the highest release of greenhouse gases out of all the inhalers out there. So if somebody's using that inhaler more, then that's automatically going to put up their footprint on the environment. But again, this is a very difficult balance. These blue inhalers are life-saving for people. They do relieve symptoms. It's really important that people have got one at hand. Unfortunately, we've seen cases where some practices are rationing people to one, two, or even three in a year and saying they can't get any more, rather than addressing the reasons for their poor control. So when we're talking about conventional asthma treatment, I was trained that there were two types. There was the relievers and there was the preventers. The relievers are usually blue. They work fast, they treat symptoms, and patients really feel the benefit from them. There is one major downside, is they don't actually treat anything to do with the asthma. They don't treat the inflammation that actually causes the symptoms. The brown inhaler, on the other side, people don't notice an immediate benefit from it. It builds up over time, 4 to 6 weeks typically. And because there's no immediate impact, people generally don't see that the benefit of taking it regularly. But in the back, inflammation that causes the symptoms that then can go on and cause asthma attacks and even asthma deaths. So coming back to this slide where we're looking at the pathway from triggers through to exacerbations, the blue inhaler is there for relief of symptoms. It is very short-sighted to be prescribing just one of those for your patient to be using it without adequate prevention, because in the background that inflammation is increasing. That's causing even more symptoms, which then drives them to use more of the blue inhaler, and also increases the risk of exacerbations as well. There are some biomechanics going on in the background where the inhaler is actually upregulating the cells that actually increase symptoms, increase inflammation, and cause asthma attacks. So it isn't just that you're masking the inflammation, you're actually increasing it by overusing that blue inhaler. But as I said, it's very difficult because patients do feel the benefit and they do need it there in case they are having significant symptoms. So prevention is key. And part of that is about patient awareness of their triggers, of what symptoms mean and what their treatment's there for. And then we need to be suppressing that inflammation. If you're suppressing inflammation, you're reducing the obstruction, you're reducing their symptoms, and you're helping to prevent exacerbations. You're not going to prevent every exacerbation, every symptom, because as I said, triggers are variable, they're unpredictable. And because you don't know that inflammation is there or how what level it's at without doing regular pheno testing, then it's very hard for patients to know whether their treatment is actually working or not. So if they're taking a blue inhaler regularly, in most cases, that will treat mostly inflammation, but actually just be make sure they're aware that actually their symptoms may come or go depending on their triggers. The way that we suppress that inflammation, there's several different treatments. So the brown inhaler, the inhaled corticosteroid, combination inhalers that contain corticosteroid. Montelukast has got some anti-inflammatory actions as well. And then as symptoms get worse, you might progress onto triple therapy with ICS-LABA and LAMA as well, and then even onto biologics through a specialist severe asthma center. And I'll talk a little bit about how some of these drugs do that job. So again, I've already talked about the fact that taking too much of your blue inhaler can increase the inflammation and bronchoconstriction within the lungs just because of upregulation of different receptors in different cells. But actually, there is a clear scientific rationale for adding a LABA, so a long-acting bronchodilator, to an inhaled steroid. By blocking those receptors for a long period, you actually can downregulate the inflammation and you increase the potency of the inhaled steroid. And that is something that we've known about for a long time, but we're only really understanding it in clear detail now. Just to say, if you were to prescribe somebody a LABA on its own, it massively increases their risk of having asthma attacks and death because it isn't treating any of the direct inflammation. But it does make the ICS more potent if they're taken in combination. Recently, guidelines have actually added LAMAs, so drugs like tiotropium, into the asthma guidelines. And again, this isn't just for bronchodilation, although it does do that, but it also has an effect on the receptors that cause bronchoconstriction directly and actually fills them, stops them getting stimulated. And it has an effect on the cholinergic nerve as well. So it helps to sort of increase the stability of the airway at that point. So there's lots of ways in which bronchodilators work if they're long acting and in combination with inhaled corticosteroids. Biologics are probably the big new thing in asthma. And when I was sort of training and even in my early years doing asthma, once somebody was at the top of the treatment we could give in primary care, we were referring them basically for steroid therapy and monitoring in secondary. Now we know there's lots of different places within the, certainly within the allergy pathways, that we can start to calm down and dampen down the inflammation and prevent IgE and eosinophils from having impact on the lungs themselves. And for some people, these are absolutely game-changing. You're getting them down to standard doses of inhaled steroids rather than triple therapy and very high doses and oral steroids regularly. So one thing I would definitely say is if you've got somebody with asthma that isn't very well controlled and you think they're taking inhalers regularly, then refer them for consideration of specialty treatments and investigations. I said there's several versions out there, most of them working on the allergy pathway, although tezepelumab works on some non-allergic cells as well. So this year, we're 10 years after the National Review of Asthma Deaths. So not sure whether you've heard of it in detail, but basically a panel of experts sifted through in detail 195 deaths over 1 year that were caused or attributed to asthma. Their notes were investigated, family, friends, clinicians were interviewed. And the idea was that we weren't going to be putting blame on any one person for any one death, but we were looking for trends and things that could have contributed to that. And the report was meant to be groundbreaking, but has actually achieved very, very little over the last 10 years. It identified some very clear factors involved in the death of people with asthma and lots of things that highlight where people are being put at risk of death and made some several recommendations for preventing future deaths. So we will share the slides outside of this, and I'll try not to spend too long going through all the different findings of the report, but it was broken down into different sections. And the first section was use of NHS services. We found that nearly half of people who died from asthma in this report didn't seek any medical intervention after their asthma attack. And whether that's because they were just used to their symptoms or they didn't know how to seek support or whether they were just caught out by a very sudden onset of an asthma attack is hard to tell. But importantly, it's very just important to say that many people didn't actually seek any help before they died. Majority of people were under primary care, so they weren't under specialist supervision at all. And this sort of goes with the fact, I think I'll talk a bit later on, is that the majority of deaths were in people with mild and moderate asthma, not severe asthma, which perhaps hints that there is a complacency around this group where people maybe aren't taking their medications as often as they ought to prevent asthma attacks, not seeking help as often as they ought to, and maybe we're not paying them as much attention as well. A good proportion, so 10%, died not long after being in hospital for a treatment for their asthma. And in 20%, they had attended for an asthma attack in the last year. So about two-thirds of people felt that there were some factors around, or it was felt there were some factors around them, such as smoking, secondhand smoking, and non-attendance at appointments and so on. But very important is that people weren't recognizing that death was a possible adverse effect of asthma symptoms and asthma attacks. They were very complacent about what was going on. And there was certainly a low perception of risk, especially as people got younger. The majority of people who died in this report actually were diagnosed as adults. And certainly two-thirds over the age of 15. So again, that's something else just to sort of bear in mind, that perhaps we're putting a lot of effort into children, but people with later onset asthma, we need to put a little bit more attention into. And mental health and substance abuse was certainly a factor in about a quarter of patients. And coming on to the things that actually we need to be doing better. So about a quarter of those who died weren't given an asthma action plan at any point. 40% or so had no evidence for having had an asthma review in primary care in the last year before their death. And triggers for their asthma wasn't recorded in over half of those patients. As I said, over half of people had mild to moderate asthma, which perhaps hints at some complacency, but also people just having poorly controlled, undertreated asthma. It's clear from the records that actually a lot of healthcare professionals didn't have good knowledge of the guidelines or weren't implementing them as they were meant to. And we talked earlier about overuse of reliever inhalers, and 40% of patients had more than 12 reliever inhalers in the last year before they died. And that is a clear mark that we can see on our systems. We need to look for it, but actually that's something that we need to do better at. Six of the patients who died had more than 50 reliever inhalers, so very surprising that they weren't known about. The other side, when we're talking about treating asthma, we need to make sure people are taking enough preventers. So the threshold for this was that people should have been taking 12 preventer prescriptions in the year. 40% of them had less than four in the year, so they're clearly under-treating their inflammation. So just to highlight the key points there, so the NRAD National Review of Asthma Deaths showed that preventer underuse increases the risk of death and reliever overuse increases the risk of death. And this is sort of leading us on to sort of a bit of a step change in how we're managing asthma at the moment. We do rely, and we almost ask our patients to rely on their blue inhaler. And a study that Asthma and Lung UK did last year based on our annual survey, so it's about 11, 12,000 patients, we asked them how many of their inhalers they were using. And we identified that 74% were overusing their reliever inhaler. And these are people from the general population. The fact they're engaged with Asthma and Lung UK show they're actually probably quite motivated around their asthma. So these aren't even the worst cases that we're picking up here. And over 30% were underusing their preventer inhaler. So again, if you go back to what I was talking about before, there are people who are clearly getting a lot of symptoms and putting themselves at risk by overusing their blue inhaler, but they're not treating the inflammation in the background. There's lots of reasons why people do this. Some people do just prefer the reliever. They know it works for them and suits them. Prescribed a reliever. We hear that quite often, that people have only got a blue inhaler and they haven't got something to dampen down and prevent their symptoms. There is still a lot of worry out there about steroid use. And I tell my patients that actually the dose in their preventer inhaler, if they're taking it properly, is extremely low. It's not getting into the system. It's not going to affect them. And it's definitely nothing like the steroids you imagine bodybuilders are using. We have an issue that some people can't afford having two prescriptions. They have to make a choice as to which inhaler they're going to get. And of course, we signpost people to prepayment certificates and so on for support with that. Asthma symptoms are variable, which means that people don't see the necessary benefit of taking a brown inhaler regularly. They will rely on their blue one as and when they need to. And it might be their symptoms are very occasional, only come on when in contact with certain triggers. So we now move on to something that is, say, getting into the news a little bit more now, and that's anti-inflammatory relievers. So there is an alternative to salbutamol. From this chart, you can see that in the bottom line, you've got somebody who's taken placebo, and there's no significant increase in their FEV1. But in somebody who's taking salbutamol and in somebody who's taking formoterol, you get a very similar increase in FEV1. And importantly, you get it as quickly. There's a very, very slight delay in formoterol, but actually, in terms of the effectiveness and the speed of onset, it gives the same efficacy as salbutamol. Formoterol is a key ingredient in many of the ICS-LABA inhalers that we have available. So in theory, we could be using a formoterol ICS combination inhaler, not just as a preventer to treat the inflammation, but also to treat symptoms, which gives lots of other benefits as well. So because asthma is variable, they might only get an increase in symptoms at certain times of the year, but we tend to give somebody a fixed dose ICS, which works all the way through the year at the same level. If you were to put them on a formoterol ICS combination, then whenever they get an increase in symptoms, they will also tailor their prevention treatment at the same time. So they'll take more ICS at the same time they're treating their symptoms. So that's something we think can make a real big difference in terms of managing people who are getting frequent asthma symptoms or even occasional asthma symptoms. So air is an anti-inflammatory reliever. You start to hear a lot more of it and hopefully hear more of it when the new NICE BTS guidelines come out later this year. We can use it in ICS in combination with a formoterol to treat the symptoms of asthma. And for most people, that is going to be part of a MART regime. That's when somebody takes a dose morning and evening and can use the same inhaler in between times if they get symptoms. But it's also now evidence that you could use it in place of the conventional blue and brown treatment at the earlier stages of traditional guidelines. So for people who are getting very occasional symptoms, so it might just be hay fever or if they're doing exercise, then they just use it as and when they need to. And actually the evidence shows that actually for people who would normally be taking a brown inhaler on its own and where adherence is quite patchy, then it's a useful way of helping to sort of help control them. And the most important thing about this is it means that actually their blue relief inhaler is not being used. So there's no unopposed SABA use. So I hope that makes sense. And the benefits of air for patients is it gives them a very quick relief of symptoms like their blue inhaler would have done. It also treats their inflammation, which it goes on to cause more symptoms. But so you're treating that. There's no unopposed SABA use. Patients are then found to get fewer symptoms and fewer asthma attacks, less unscheduled visits to the NHS. In total, they end up with a lower overall steroid use. So even if they weren't using their brown inhaler regularly, if they were taking air or even MART, they show that actually because they're using less oral steroids, because they're getting less exacerbations, their overall steroid dose over a large population is actually better. Because they've got one inhaler, it's better for the environment and they're not using those very unfriendly blue inhalers, which have got the extra greenhouse gases in. It's cheaper for people who pay for their prescriptions. They're only needing one prescription rather than two. And also it's a much simpler way of managing asthma. So they can use this one inhaler whenever they choose to, rather than having to decide which inhaler they use at any particular point. I say the new evidence shows that at BTS steps 1 and 2, air compared to as needed salbutamol reduces the risk of flare-ups by almost 2/3. It also reduces A&E visits, hospitalizations by about the same amount. And then looking at step 2, so if you're comparing air to a daily brown plus salbutamol, you're reducing visits to hospital by a third. And as I said before, the average dose of steroids is much lower when they're using air because you're not getting exacerbations. So some people are saying, well, surely we should give this to everybody. And although it's a game changer, many people, not just people with asthma, but also healthcare professionals are quite attached to blue inhalers. There is a big culture shift that needs to happen to get people changed over. But better asthma control should always be the priority. Because of licensing, air and MART is only available for over 12s at the moment. There are some studies going on. COPD it's not applicable for, and if they've got asthma and COPD together, then again, air and MART wouldn't be suitable for them. If somebody hasn't got great inhaler technique, then actually you need to have them on inhaler that suits them. And similarly, not everybody gets on with formoterol. There's some people that gives them tachycardia, palpitations. Some people just feel very jittery on it, in which case a non-formoterol inhaler is more appropriate, which you can't do air or MART with. And people with more severe asthma will end up on higher doses of steroid or inhaled steroids anyway. And actually, you can't use higher doses in air and MART. So it's really essential that you don't just swap people over. You have a good discussion. And there's lots of support out there to help you with that culture change with your patients. An important thing that's taken up a lot of my time recently is trying to get the Asthma and Lung UK website up to date, because we've relied very obviously actually on our standard asthma attack advice, where somebody would take a puff of their blue inhaler every 30 seconds up to 10 puffs. Formoterol doesn't work in exactly the same way, so you can take up to 6 puffs and probably 1 puff every 1 to 3 minutes. And there isn't much evidence backing that, but that's certainly what the drug companies are recommending. So moving on now to the guidelines. We've got a bit of an issue at the moment in that BTS, Sign, NICE and GINA are all competing a little bit. GINA is the most up-to-date. They produced an update last year, well, 2 years ago, which highly recommended air and MART as a treatment regime for people with asthma. GINA are the international guidelines, and they're recognised by every country in the world, except the UK. The reason for that is the UK have got NICE, and they prefer everything to go through NICE in the first instance. However, we have got, and this has been confirmed to be coming out in October this year now, we've got a combined NICE, BTS and SIGN guideline, which should bring all that evidence together. They will have taken into account the new evidence that GINA have used in their guideline. But in the meantime, I'm advising people that actually GINA is a robust guideline. It's using some very, very good evidence. And actually, it is appropriate to use air and MART in a greater way by referencing that. So when we think about which guideline, they actually all say very, very similar. We should regularly monitor people with asthma, at least every year, but also when they've got poor control. We should always check the cause of people's symptoms. So don't just presume somebody with asthma who's coughing, they're coughing due to their asthma. It could be postnasal drip. It could be breathing pattern disorder. It could be gastric reflux. It could be tumours. There could be anything causing their symptoms. Don't just assume it's their asthma. And it's absolutely crucial that every stage of their treatment, we're checking their adherence to their medication, their techniques and their triggers. And by adherence, I also mean just seeing if they're overusing their reliever. However they take their reliever, are they using it more than they ought to? And at each stage, you then, if you've addressed all those things, you can step them up a level, keep monitoring them, step them down if they're well controlled for more than 3 months, but bear in mind their pattern of disease as well. And as I said earlier, if somebody's got poorly controlled asthma, we've got lots of options in specialist severe asthma clinics to offer patients. It's always worth going there to firstly nail down the diagnosis. Is there something else that's triggering off their symptoms? But also then, are there some medicines and other treatments that we can then put in place for them? So when we're looking at the different stages of asthma management, initially we would be given a bronchodilator for relief. The new way of thinking that GINA and hopefully the new UK guidelines will come out with will be suggesting that air is a really good alternative to that. And then the next step in our treatment was people on as required relievers. So there shouldn't be many people at BTS stage one. If they've got asthma, they've got asthma, they've got risk of inflammation, they should be have treatment to damp down their inflammation, prevent symptoms and asthma attacks. However, there are people out there who we know their only trigger is perhaps hay fever or a virus. And in those situations, then you might have considered that just having a blue inhaler on its own was enough. Moving them over to air only, so having a formoterol ICS combination as PRN, will not only treat their symptoms as and when, but also means that they've got some protection in the background to help protect them as well. First stage of preventive treatment was always the brown inhaler, so an inhaled corticosteroid. We've now moved on so that actually people are either on air or on MART as the way forward with this. Similarly, the next step up, we would then move people on to normally put people on a combination inhaler. Now it's making sure they're on MART and using that appropriately. In the NICE guidelines, though, you will see that as an alternative to combination therapy, it recommends ICS and montelukast together. And the reason for this was purely driven by cost. They're as effective as each other, but actually putting people on an ICS labber was more expensive than just adding in montelukast, which is why it took prominence within those guidelines. However, I think it's worth bearing in mind, will a patient take one inhaler correctly and regularly, or will they take an inhaler with the tablet correctly and regularly? And that's different for different people. But generally, I find that having people on one treatment as a combination inhaler works better. And GINA recommends sort of going up to higher dose combination inhaler, but not as MART. So you would then need to add in a different reliever inhaler, whereas the conventional guidelines are suggesting making sure that people are on both the combination inhaler plus montelukast at that point. And then it's considering whether people would benefit from having a long-acting muscarinic such as Spiriva at that point. So this is a summary of what the GINA guidelines show. And they're sort of saying there is an option. The preferred option is people having the ICS formoterol combination initially and then building up from there. Whereas the conventional, or if they don't get on with the ICS formoterol, it's about having an ICS with a LABA, but even so with a SABA. But actually at that stage, they're actually advocating if somebody is getting intermittent symptoms, they should also take their preventer at the same time, which gives you the same effect as perhaps the air treatment would do, but not as effective. I've put this chart on the slide, basically more for information. I'm not going to talk through it. There's a similar one within the NICE guideline pages as well, which covers the equivalent doses of various inhaled steroids to show there's different equivalents out there. Some smaller particle drugs are more potent, different steroids are more potent. So really important that you're on board with that and you notice the differences between different prescriptions when you prescribe them. So as I said, it's really, really crucial that you're supporting your patients, especially if you're going to be changing treatments. So the sort of things that I would be sort of looking at when I'm sort of reviewing somebody, is the diagnosis right? Have they got education about their asthma and what they need to do to look after it, the importance of their treatment? And in every single case, I send people to the Asthma Lung UK website. There's different websites on there depending on where they are in their journey. So there's diagnosis pages, exacerbation pages, there's your annual review pages and so on. So you can tailor that to what your patients need. I do work with them to try and identify and address triggers. I very rarely do allergy testing or refer for allergy testing, but actually it's more about getting people to recognize what does set them off. So is a change in the weather, is the pollution levels, is it pollen, when they get a cold? And these should be not just triggers for their asthma, but triggers to change their behavior as well. So if they know hay fever is a trigger, then start taking preventative medicines at an earlier stage. It's really important to make sure that you're picking the right inhaler for your patient. So make sure they can use their inhaler correctly at all times. It's something they'll adhere with. There are some inhalers which are once a day, others which is that you can use as MART. So pick that up. And actually, I always share, as well as showing my patients their inhaler and how to use it, I then send them a video regularly so they can have a look at the video and check they're using it correctly. And that's part of QOF as well, make sure that patients can use their inhalers. And one way I structure my consultations is actually working through an asthma action plan. So from that, you've got three zones with the Asthma and Lung UK one. You've got good control, and you can talk patients through what they need to do to stay well. You've got what they do when they're getting symptoms. So you can sort of talk them through what symptoms to look out for, what their triggers might be, what things they can do then to get their disease back into control. And then the third sort of part of the plan is actually what to do in asthma attack. And actually so many patients don't get this explained to them, which is perhaps one reason why people don't come forward quick enough, as we saw in NRAD. I've put on the slide several links that I regularly use. The bottom one, which is the Asthma and Lung UK Health Professionals site, is currently having a bit of a revamp, and there's been lots of great resources on there shortly. But at the moment, it's where you can access inhaler videos that you want to share, all the action plans, and there's lots of different versions of that. So we've got asthma action plans in three different formats. Firstly, we've got the main adult one and the main child one. We've got an adult and MART action plan, and we've got an air action plan for people who are just taking it, PRN. We've also got different versions depending on how you use yours. Most of them we're integrating within ARDEMS, System 1 and EMIS. We've got ones that you can download straight from our website, or you can buy hard copies as well. We've set them up so they're trifold, so if they are printed up, you can sort of fold them and use them like a leaflet. But we've also got black and white printer-friendly ones because we know that many practices don't like you using all the ink up on the coloured ones and ones that use a lot of ink. And we've also got it in eight common languages as well. So, yeah, definitely worth having a look for some of your deprived populations and the populations who don't speak English as a first language. Something we thought that was crucial when we put these action plans together was actually guidance notes for healthcare professionals. So whether this is you or your direct nurses in your practice or other people who are using asthma action plans. And it talks you through not just how to fill in the asthma action plans, but some key points within asthma management, just to help make sure that they're all trained up, you're doing the right things for the right reasons. We've got, if you are changing somebody's inhaler to air or MART, we've got pages for patients so you can talk through how they'll benefit from it, how to use it, how they can get an action plan, and also the different asthma attack advice on there as well. So we found this is a crucial way of just helping people on that journey, especially as we've all become very wedded to blue inhalers over time. And there's a link there for that as well. So hopefully that, even though it's been a bit of a whistle-stop tour, we've covered enough there for you. More than happy to take questions, but also happy for Ellie to sort of pass on any emails and things if anybody follows up with those afterwards as well.
Yeah, absolutely. If anybody's got anything that they think of off the talk, we can pass that on to Dr. Whittemore. Has anybody got any questions they want to put? I'm aware it's 10 to 2, so probably we're in our last 5 or 10 minutes of the talk. Anything about the resources?
One thing to say about the resources is spend some time going through the Aspirin Lung UK pages, because we have tried to cover everything at every point of the patient journey. Including why people should go to asthma reviews. So you might want to send that out when you're sending out invites, what people should do after having an asthma attack. So actually you can send them plans to go with that.
Fab. Sam, I can see you've raised a hand.
Oh, yeah. Just wanted to ask, sometimes patients present with symptoms typical of asthma, but at the time you're seeing them, they do not have those symptoms, probably because they are not exposed to those triggers.
Yeah.
And same thing happens when they come in for spirometry and, you know, it's come back normal. But then you've got this person who you think has got asthma. You give them salbutamol to try and they come back to say, oh, it's, you know, when they had the symptoms, salbutamol was, you know, helpful. Was that enough ground? I mean, is that enough ground to start these patients on, you know, the asthma pathway, I mean, treatments, even without having proven, you know, spirometry or FeNO to support that?
And that problem was made worse through COVID when our waits for spirometry were so long, we had to start people on treatments. So by the time they had spirometry, they were either better or we didn't know whether they had asthma in the first place. That's why I like when people present with symptoms to put them straight onto a peak flow diary. So if you've spoken to somebody or you've seen somebody in an acute clinic where they've presented with asthma-like symptoms, so whether you start treatment or not, and you should really start them if you can, giving them a peak flow diary. I send them a link to the Asthma and Lung UK webpage on how to do peak flows, because there's a video there to talk them through it, and then arrange for follow-up after about 2 to 3 weeks. So if they're acutely unwell with their asthma when you see them, and you'd either put them on steroids or an inhaler, and I'd always put them on the preventer, not just a blue inhaler, then you should be able to see over that 2 weeks an improvement in their peak flows and their asthma symptoms as well. And that's a big part of the diagnosis. So that would be my approach to that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
The difficult thing with that is if somebody else has done it and you see somebody who's better and on the steroid inhaler and they think that might be making them better, you've then got a tough decision as to whether you wean them off it and then keep monitoring peak flow or what you do in that situation.
Oh, Daniela, did you have a question?
Yes, I'm sorry. I would like to ask, what age can we refer for FeNO testing for children reliably?
So in my practice, we do FeNO from the age of 5. We yes. try it. But most places, it's probably about 7, 8.
So to diagnose children with asthma, what do we do? Do we use peak flow?
So it really depends on how good, because even at 5, 6, 7 and even some older patients, they might not be able to do peak flows effectively. They've certainly struggled with spirometry. It's always worth a try to see if they can get the hand of peak flows, and that's really useful. And it's also a good educational tool and a good way for them to keep monitoring if they need to. Quite often, you almost need to diagnose them with suspected asthma. So you recode them. You might start them on treatment, or you might start to monitor them over time. But then the important thing is then following them up so that you can repeat the test when they're old enough to do it.
Thank you very much.
It's difficult, and guidelines don't cover the practicalities of that. They're all based on research, which says that in research clinics, they were doing spirometry and phenol on 5-year-olds and 7-year-olds.
Yeah, it's very hard to kind of rely on spirometry in some small children. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Danielle, and thanks for jumping in there. So, yeah, I think we'll probably wrap up a little early, but we really appreciate you all coming. Apologies again for the broken link that we first sent out. And I'm sure you'd all like to join me in thanking Dr. Whittemore for the talk that he gave. Super practical, great links, great advice, and lovely to have Q&A time. Thank you.
If there are any more questions, please feel free to share them for early later.